This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, Halflings! It's me, Jasper William Cartwright, and I am joined today by...
Jeremy Cobb, but Emma Carlson from Blackwater D&D calls me Odiferous Shanks.
Whoa.
Yes. Dude. A nickname that is incredibly relevant because it's the nickname that I had when I was... it's the character that I created when I was on their DM roulette, which you are just about to do tonight.
I am doing that tonight. I'm waking up at 3:30 in the morning to do this.
Yes.
I am strapping myself in. I have energy drinks at the ready. And then I have to go to a full-time job after that. And then an audition in London. Tomorrow is going to be a wild day. But what is even more wild is, Halflings, listen closely. We have finally completed the set. It is happening. It is here. It is right now. And I'm very, very excited to welcome our next guest onto Three Black Halflings. It is right. It is Brian Murphy from D20, DM of NADPOD. Welcome to Three Black Halflings, the last person from NADPOD.
How are you doing? I'm finally here. I'm doing great.
Yes. Yes.
I'm doing pro wrestler poses. I'm doing the Rock style sniffing, taking in the crowd.
Overwhelming. Can you Stone Cold some energy drinks together?
And slapping then, together and then, two monster energy drinks, pouring it.
Yeah. The crowd have handmade infinity gauntlets, and they're all adding the final stone that says Murph on it. Each one just looks like a member of NADPOD's face. Just all adding.
Scarily realistic.
Perfect merch idea. Oh yeah, just. They're not even different colors. It doesn't even look cool. It's just really graphic images of our faces.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're like slightly silicone as well. So they're a bit squidgy and just like flesh-like as well. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're not stones. They're just weird models of your faces.
Oh, yeah. Just little rubber faces on a gauntlet. Disgusting.
They especially smile. I can make them talk when I make a fist. Look.
Especially with you and Jacob got the long hair right now. You're rocking the long hair. So it'd just be some hairy little.
Yeah.
Anyway,
we use some real hair.
Yeah.
Actual human hair.
Actual human hair.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Absolutely disgusting. But welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We are so excited to have you on. We have now had every single member of NADPOD on the show in some capacity, which is extremely exciting. Very excited to talk to you today.
Oh my god!
This is the wrong dungeon and the wrong dragon.
Full Prince vibe? Woof!
This makes them even more black!
Cake glitches and pitches.
And lands in the cusp of a teaspoon.
Oh, no.
On a nat 20.
No!
You think this is just a game?
That's disgusting and I love it.
Yeah. We're about to get into something real big now.
So, first place we always start. Is we always ask, what is your TTRPG origin story? So what is like the first moment that a young Murph was like, I'm gonna play TTRPGs.
This is gonna be my job.
This is my thing.
You know, I didn't play that many TTRPGs. I guess like, did you guys ever play HeroQuest?
The MMORPG.
That's EverQuest.
Oh,
which
City
I also played, and I also played City of Heroes. I was big into MMOs for sure, so that's definitely part of it. But there was this game called HeroQuest that I think actually they're coming out with a new one. It's like super cool. It was this game that I think back in the day it was like $50 or something, which for a board game was like insane. So I only had one friend who had it, and it's kind of a a DM's dream now, because it comes with just like 50 minis of, like, you get like an entire adventuring party, you get all of their stats, and you get all of these like minions and stuff, and then somebody acts as like essentially the dungeon master, and it's like basically D&D light. So I played that game and I loved it, and but I wasn't around TTRPGs really. Like, I didn't know anybody playing D&D growing up, so we would sort of make up games. Like, we me and my friends made a Dragon Ball Z game that was like based on the Hero Quest thing a little bit, where we would, like, we would use the board, and then you would go into different rooms, and there was like a deck of cards that would like decide who you fought in the room. And your attacks were based on your power level. So we'd have a calculator there. It would be like, well, my power level is 5,000. So my kick does 10% of my power level. So, and you're sitting there and doing, it's like very, very crunchy. But it was, I don't know, sort of a fun way for us to live in those worlds and everything, and do like sort of a pen and paper version of video games. And then I didn't play D&D until we met Brennan. At a party, this at this point would have been like 5 or 6 years ago. And it, that was sort of the proto D20. It was like a lot of the D20 crew. It was me, Siobhan, Zach, Emily, and a couple other of our friends played with Brennan. And as soon as I played it, I was like, oh, this is like the better version of what I was trying to do when I was a child.
I think I think I had a very similar experience. I remember making I would run a game at lunchtime during like secondary school, which I think is high school for you guys.
Yeah.
Where I would like tape pieces of A4 paper together and draw. I drew this huge map, and I basically made a version of like I'm trying to think of like Total War or like Conquest, of like that kind of thing. But I would allow everyone to like make their own army, and I would decide what like abilities they had, and then basically what would happen is everyone would come to me one by one over lunchtime, so that no one knew what like the other moves other people would do. I mean, the system was a mess. It definitely wasn't fair. One dude had like a dragon army, and he just absolutely just because he flew and could breathe fire, and like it was like. Like, it was so unbalanced.
Yes.
Man, we had some wild fun doing that.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah, I think I can definitely I definitely get that, like, oh, I'm gonna take it and make it into something that like I want to play, and I think that was that my version of that for sure.
Yeah, that's it's funny that you had kind of the same experience. I think that there are a lot of kids that have that experience of being like, no game is capturing what kind of we want to do. So I think there's more options now, but back in the day, it's like, if you wanted to play some kind of TTRPG, you kind of had to play Dungeons and Dragons or something. It was very hard to find, like, I like this property. Like, I want to play Dragon Ball Z as a game. I'm pretty sure I could just look up online right now and there'd be 50 versions of it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
But back then, you know, we couldn't do that.
Yeah. For me, it was, we didn't even have a game. We didn't even use numbers. We had a friend who was a really good artist. Shout out to Donald. And me and my other two friends, Chris and Taylor, would ask Donald to draw our characters that we made up, like our superhero characters. So we'd be like, what would your power be? We were like 17. But we had these elaborately described superhero characters because we all liked comic books and comic book characters. So Donald was really good at comic book art, and he would draw them all. It was like, oh, yeah. And then we sit separately and imagine them.
Yeah, and just look at them. And be like, what if I could do something with this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then the thing is, I feel like me and my friends probably would have tried to do that, but it would have devolved into, yeah, but teleportation is stupid. Like, we'd have just ended up spending ages worrying about the mechanics.
Is it really you,
powers.
Though? Like, who you reappears? Is it like you die every time you teleport and then assemble a new you thinks it was the old you?
That is exactly it.
It's the ship of Theseus, man. Give me my lunchbox.
The ship of that definitely wasn't getting mentioned in my secondary school. If the ship of Theseus came up, I'd have been like, duh, what? So, it's so funny. I think like we're kind of piecing together parts of this this epic party. This once in a, because I think Zach gave us like some details, and then so it's quite a fun thing to be like, oh, imagine this. It's like becoming the holy grail of TTRPGs. This one party where the D20 crew met.
Like, yeah, it was quite amazing. It was literally the first time I hung out with Brennan. Like, I don't know if I've ever really hung out with Brennan outside of D&D, because even if we went and hung out and got coffee today, we would still talk about D&D, so it doesn't, yeah. Like, that will always be...
That is exactly how I feel about Jeremy. Like, no matter how hard we try, true. I guarantee you we would... longer than 10 minutes, I don't think it'd be possible.
Yeah.
What about you and Brennan? How long do you reckon you'd go before the conversation naturally...
It would literally be instant, because he would show up and I'd be like, what's going on? And there would be something going on with D&D, definitely. Be like, got back from this millionth stream that I've done and this thing. And I'd be like, oh, cool. How'd that go? We just did the finale. We would just talk. It's just what it is, you know?
Well, you nearly mentioned it there, but so you just completed the finale of your second campaign.
Yes.
Which is incredibly well done. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
You do much longer campaigns than we do. that's a whole big old thing. So we'll do this little back to front, this question. How was the finale? And then we'll ask you about the sort of creation of the show and everything. How did that all go, rounding the story off the second time?
It ended up going really well. I was kind of trying. It was tough going into it, because, like, you know, when we do these long campaigns, there's all this anticipation. Like, a lot of people, as campaign two started, there's all these comparisons to campaign one, where people are at times literally being like, well, I don't know about this, because in episode 10 of campaign one they were here, but in episode 10 of campaign two you're here. And I'm like, I'm not gonna do the exact same thing twice. That would be terrible.
Imagine if you just took your notes, if I just did different towns but the same thing. Just reskin it. Just literally just the same thing but different.
A mahube. You just call it a mahube
So this one ended up being a little shorter, and as I was going into the finale, I was like panicking a little bit, because it was like the first one was 100 episodes, this one was 40 episodes. So I was like, how do we make, without it being something where like gods are coming down out of the sky and throwing meteors, how do we make it special? And the way we're able to do that, spoiler alert if you haven't heard our second campaign, but we were able to bring Lou back, and we did the two parties, because we had the Hexblood Centurions arc with Lou.
Yeah.
So we did two boss fights at the same time, where we cut back and forth, but it was all one initiative. So it'd be like on this person's initiative, we cut to that setting. So it was very complicated and kind of hard to plan, but ended up sort of safely landing the plane, which, like, as soon as we finished with all that, I just like went to bed and then woke up the next day and just drank bourbon and did nothing. And like,
yes. Oh my God. That sounds like my perfect, like, 2 days. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, such an epic session that all I can do tomorrow is drink bourbon.
Yeah.
That sounds,
I'm just like, I'm just going
to
wake up and I have to be,
that'll be it.
I can't do anything. Yeah.
I think I would wake up, just check the files are all there, then I think I'd have to just do that bit first,
right,
before I, you know, because I'd worry about that all day, I think, otherwise.
Oh, I do too. Yeah, because I try to stay out of the comments, not just because, like, you know, I think, like, I'm sensitive. I think a lot of people are, like, sensitive. If you get like one criticism, you're sitting there being like, oh, I don't care how much praise I get, this one's really, really sticking in there. This one's really going to ruin my weekend. So I try to stay out of it a little bit, but then also because I don't want it to shift the way that, like, I run the game. I don't want it to, like, take over. I don't want it to be, like, in the back of my head. But I always have to check the comments after the episode posts, just like the initial thing, just to make sure people aren't like, hey, did anyone else think it was weird that at an hour and a half, there was just 15 minutes of silence and then it just cut to a different episode, and you could just hear Murph eating a pizza and drinking bourbon in the background?
Yeah, well, luckily we get tweeted occasionally being like, hey, guys, Just so that you know, you fade out at 40 minutes and then come back real loud at like 52. And I was like, oh, God.
There was an episode recently where it was just Unati talking for 5 minutes, but their audio was gone. Their audio was gone. So it was just me going,
indeed.
No, I totally agree. For 10 minutes straight.
And it just seems like some weird bit that you're doing.
Yeah.
At least the good thing is as an American, you have an enthusiastic, I feel like as a British person, I do quite a subdued, yeah. So I feel like it would have been a lot more weird.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? At least with you, it was clear. It was yes, I agree. Yeah. You know what I mean? Whereas with me, it'd just be yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh. It'd be some weird ASMR thing where it's what the hell?
Right.
They put out?
And I'd be Caldwell, you fucking moron.
Yeah, literally, with no context whatsoever.
I was curious, going into this season, because obviously your approach was to Eldermorn has been really, really different to your approach to Bohumia.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you were trying to change? Maybe not without going into too many specifics in case a person hasn't actually heard it, but in terms of how you were approaching the two campaigns as a DM.
I think that this campaign, I was doing a little bit more world building as far as being of planning out truly what does this continent look like and what are the different factions and everything. Whereas first campaign, we kind of stumbled into that where it was literally I was laying the track down as we were going, where I had the name of the world Bohumia and stuff. And I think I had the name of a couple other places and I had ideas, but it would literally be they're in this town. Cool. I have this town built. Last episode, I come up with a reason for them to leave that town. Next town, I build that town. And so it was very piece by piece by piece. But this one, I went into it trying to do a little bit more world building. And then kind of the bigger thing, I think, is I was also trying to get away from what we did in campaign one, which is to have the characters in a place for, we had a format of they're in a spot for 10 episodes. They help out with some problems around town that feeds into the larger story. So I was we have to do a little something different. So this one's a little bit more of an odyssey. It's people, they're essentially chasing the chosen one and trying to get to her before the bad guys can get there. Which actually I hadn't expected that to mean that it kind of had to be a short campaign. I basically realized 30 episodes in, I'm they have to get to this girl at some point. I can't keep pushing this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't keep moving it away. Whereas with the first campaign, it was a little easier to stretch it because it could just be they go to the next town. And then there's new problems in the next town. And this one was very much they're still meeting people along the way. They're still doing stuff there. But it is this it pulls a lot from The Witcher and stuff. And Geralt chasing after trying to get to Ciri. That's kind of where this idea started. So they're trying to get to this Emily's character's childhood friend. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the difference in the adventure arcs. Is this one's more of they don't necessarily spend a lot of time in one town. They go, they get a little bit of information, and then they move on to the next thing. So it's paced way different. But then I quickly realized, I was this has to end now, because they have to find her.
Because it's just the one goal. I think that's one of the big differences is in Bohumia, the plot sort of arose around them as they were going.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, it was we're going in with this. This is what we're trying to do.
Right.
So there's only a certain amount of time that you can prolong them doing the thing they're trying to
do.
Yeah. And I think there's such a fun contrast of play styles, because I think that this is a good point that refers to if you're a larger DM, there's if you're a DM who is DMing at home or whatever, there are I feel those are two kind of very two of the kind of big tent poles, if you will, of how you want to run a campaign, which is do you want your players to feel the absolute center of the world, in which the world is reacting to them, and they're kind of figuring you're kind of figuring it out with them, but you kind of give them this heroes, almost a classic hero's journey, or do you want to do the other way around, which is which is typically the way that I've enjoyed doing stuff, and I really enjoyed Eldermorn for this reason, was I love the idea of being like, there is an entire world and ecosystem going on around these people, and they're trying to affect their will on the world instead of the world trying to affect its will on them.
Yeah.
Like, if they just sat down, stayed in a cottage, and did nothing, like, the world would carry on, and maybe bad things would happen, maybe good things would happen, and who knows?
Yeah. It's like somebody else would...
the other version, yeah.
Somebody else would still achieve, like, some of the goals. Like, there's still other good guys out there, like, doing stuff. So, like, maybe some other people would come up in a few years and, like, solve the thing. But, like, yeah, I think that was kind of the goal, is to, like, make them very important, but not the center of the universe. Because I think in the first campaign, since I'm, you know, laying it all out as it goes, it is very much like the world is built around them, which I think doing it both ways has its advantages and
perfectly
disadvantages.
Valid, yeah, 100%.
That also allowed you, though, to jump over and do the Hexbloods arc, which you really, I don't think it would have hit quite the same in Bohemia, where, like, everything's about these people. It's like, oh, well, why are we taking a break to go pay attention to these people over here? Whereas the Hexbloods was amazing. It was like, oh, not only do we have our core people over here on this task, we have, like, all these characters, some of whom we've heard referenced before. We're now jumping over there and seeing what they're up to. And it's like, oh, dang. It made the world feel much bigger and much more lived in. It also really worked with the idea of having, like, a living, breathing world that was running separately from the players.
Yeah, thanks. Mm. Yeah, and we got to do that too with that was another situation where M threw me for a loop. Without getting too specific, there's basically like a zombie rebellion. There's like all these awakened zombies, and one is part of this rebel group, and they're about to be like executed by this like kind of evil empire. And the purpose of this character was to give like a brave speech to sort of indicate that there was this like unrest going on, but then they were gonna die. But instead, Emily grabbed him and dimension doored, and so that threw me for a loop. So I was like, well, what do we do here? Well, now we're gonna dive into it. So then we got to create new characters again, and the party was split, and that allowed us to once again, instead of it just being this like one core party, we got to meet characters that were like in this kind of rebellion, and they got to kind of solve their own problems, as opposed to it being just like, ah, the magical trio shows up and solves everything.
Yeah,
I do. Just to backtrack slightly though, Murph, I feel like you can't be like the victim in this. Like, you of all people should know that if Emily Axford has a chance
to
mess with all of your shit, she absolutely will, and will do it very, very well.
I thought I was.
We found that out a couple times in Outlaws and Outlaws.
Oh, I'm
and
sure.
It's amazing.
Yeah, she's a paladin in that, so that's a problem.
Yeah,
that's a problem.
And it gets paladin-y.
So many crits. She had like two crits in a row in one battle. Where it was just like, wow.
Emily talks to me about like builds and strategies that she has to quote fish for crits. She's like, here's how I can get the most crits possible. And she talks about fishing for crits.
Fishing for crits.
But she's so good at it. But in that particular moment, I thought I might get away with it because NatPod is pretty heavily edited. If somebody like brings up a suggestion, unless it's like very much in character and it's like part of like the scene of like the characters kind of strategizing, I tend to cut it. Like if somebody's just sitting there being like, oh, I've got a spell for this, never mind, I cut it.
Man, half of me in an episode would get completely, more than half.
Literally,
like, half is all me.
half of us get cut. We cut, like, I mean, we'll have an episode that's, you know, raw 3 hours, and then the episode is, you know, hour and 45 minutes, 2 hours. But there was a lot of raw audio of M trying to figure out how to save this dude and, like, start a fight. And then at a certain point, she just decided, like, whatever, I'll just dimension door and we'll figure it out. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I think one of the things that springs to mind for me, and I think this one is potentially pertinent to any DMs out there, especially if they're aspiring to do a show or even just to try and bet themselves as DMs, is like, how was the experience of doing something a bit more kind of curated, I guess? Because that's kind of the impression that I get is with this second campaign. I know that we've had that with Outlaws and Obelisks, is like, you know, you're thinking to yourself, how do you step this up and how do you kind of craft the story and really find these, like, you know, like you said, these kind of waypoints and make it possible to do these little kind of like side parts where you've got like the Hexbloods coming in and finding all the parts of that world. Like, what is there a different process for you in creating something that's just like fun at home, or even like the first campaign where you were sort of making stuff slightly as you were going,
right,
to really trying to craft like a story, right? Like, how do you go about like trying to then fit players into a story? Because, you know, famously, players do enjoy messing with
stuff and
making you throw all your planning out the window. So, like, how did that work out for you? Like, did you imagine it being longer, shorter, or yeah?
I didn't realize that doing sort of this chase as the main adventure would mean that it was a little bit limiting as far as length. It's like, eventually they have to get to her. And I think another thing that was different in campaign one was there were more like kind of mini bosses, because I was just figuring it out as I went along, which I think is like a good thing, because it gives the players like sort of an immediate goal. And I think if I could do sort of anything differently with campaign two is I would have maybe given another like minion that was maybe like a little lower to have been an antagonist for the first like 20 episodes or something like that. And that may have given me a little bit more leeway to go longer, but it got to a certain point where I was like, you know, the real bad guys are the main bad guys. So we gotta get to this quick. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was part of it. But then as far as like it being a little bit more complicated, I think my planning style and everything was still very similar. It was it was a lot of smoke and mirrors, because there's still a lot of stuff you can change.
That's all it all is.
Exactly.
It's all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
Like, whenever I DM them, whenever my player's like, that was sick, and I'm like, yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Making a note so I don't forget that thing I just made up on the fly.
Trying to get your, like, butt to unclench from the amount of tension you had trying to, like,
rein this horse in.
Yeah, they tried to completely bypass this awesome thing I had planned, but I just put it somewhere else, and I'm going to pretend that it was there the whole time, and I had it planned that way, yeah. but yeah, I think like anyone who says like, I don't know, I feel like there's a lot of advice sometimes where you can tell that maybe people are a little full of it, where they'll be like, yeah, when you run a module, you got to read the whole book like 3 or 4 times. You need to know like all this stuff. It's just like, no, you don't. You absolutely do not.
No, we spend most of the time on this show, I think, saying how easy our job could be. You're like, we're like, hey, we're giving you advice, but by the way, you don't really need it.
Yeah,
it's
fine. Yeah.
Like, it just it's fine. Like,
just make some stuff up.
Yeah, just make some stuff up.
Yeah.
And I think, because I think knowing the core of your world, right, knowing what, like, and I think, because we had a chat when we did the two-shot together about,
right,
like, how, because of our mutual love of certain types of games and, like, the whole kind of grimdark fantasy thing, and the fact that you kind of, you came in with that, like, as a real, like, idea, like, that's
right,
what you're
aesthetic,
kind of going
the
for.
The aesthetic of campaign two,
yeah,
really?
Aesthetic. So
yeah,
that's the word I was looking for. Yeah,
yeah,
like,
like Dark Souls,
kind of
Diablo,
then,
and
yeah,
all of that stuff. Yeah, I think that's another reason I think that maybe it ended up being a little bit shorter than the first one, where it's like, I feel like maybe there's only so many ways that as much as I kind of love those worlds, there may be. It's maybe not as much fun to spend a ton of time there. Like, I think for Eldermorn, it was more about this, like, quest to find this person and then kind of the stuff you, like, find along the way, as opposed to being, like, it's not as much as like Bahumia is like, oh, I want to get a little hobbit house and I want to live there and I want to do all of the magic and everything. And Eldermorn is a little bit of like Dark Souls where it's a little bit like,
yeah,
this is rad, but if I was,
but I can only do like 2 hours this game because I'm like, my eyes are bleeding.
I don't want to be eaten by a zombie. Like, I don't, you know.
Yeah.
Death is inevitable.
I wouldn't vacate.
Exactly.
You'll eventually lose.
Yes.
It's only a matter of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, even if you save the world, it's not really safe.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Because the baseline was like, skeletons are just walking around.
Exactly.
Yeah, baseline was super messed up anyway. So it wasn't like there was a whole lot to like, you should have saved the world a little while ago. Like, you already missed the boat.
Yeah,
right?
This was designed wrong. It was you took it down from by saving the world, you took it down from like a level 20 adventure to like, now it's a level 5 adventure. Now all you need to do is be a level 5 adventurer to survive, you know.
Yeah, but if you're still like a peasant.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
oh, no, you're
11
you're
hit points or whatever, you're so dead.
You're
like,
done.
At 10 AC, yeah, don't even think about it. Like,
yeah.
Just stay in your house and hope for the best and hope you don't die of a disease or something.
The way I envision worlds like that, because I really enjoy, there's a couple actually of noir games that I run, like D&D games. It feels like in those worlds, the water level is just always rising.
Yeah.
And all you can do is like release some of it and it... sinks down to another level, and then hopefully you release it far enough that it'll give you time to be happy and then die. And then by the time it gets high enough again, somebody else is going to come in and because it's just the world is designed to always be bad.
Right.
It's just, if it's good now, that's actually an anomaly. It's going to be bad again.
Yeah.
This HeadGum Podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers. Aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
How was that actually, running sort of a really dark campaign setting with a comedy oriented podcast? Like, because that must have been, most people wouldn't think to try and mash those two together in quite that way.
Right. Yeah. I think, it was all just an experiment. And as we got into it, we kind of found our feet. And I think speaking to like what we were talking about before is just by letting the characters not have to be, you know, the chosen ones, by allowing them to kind of be buffoons in a way. And also
flawed, right? Like flawed humans. Like, yeah, just, like, yeah, very obviously. Absolutely. Like this, I'm not good at this. This is like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
this is not my jam.
And there's there's also was something really fun about fun and different about this trio of we would talk about this in like our after show and stuff about how the original trio were all like dumb jocks, and these people are much more like introspective and like nerdy, and they're like an intelligence based party. And I think that's the in for a horror world for a comedy show, because you can point out the absurdity of being like, you're always going to be funnier if you're really smart in a horror movie. You know what I mean?
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
And yeah. I think as well, didn't all the characters in Elder Wand have charisma as dump stats?
Everyone,
like, I'm pretty sure everyone had like really bad, either minus or zero to all charisma.
M had minus one, yeah.
Yeah, quite funny, but. Yeah. I think, you know, like things like that, like, you know, you can create those contrasts, I think, that easily then create the kind of comedy and brevity and things like that. So,
yeah.
And I think it's a very interesting thing, because we noticed a difference actually when Emily came into Outlaws and Obelisks, how they kind of like the, you know, it enabled like the humor to find like a footing, and, you know, because Emily was very like used to that kind of style and things like that. And I wonder whether I don't know if you play or if you DM like any home games or anything like that that aren't explicitly, you know, like to be funny or to be this,
right?
Or to be, and I wonder whether there's like a difference for you. And the Dimension 20 is still pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether there's a difference for you when it's like, we're not explicitly trying to be funny, we're just playing the game now, whether there's a quality difference for you.
No, because I think even when I don't have as much time to play home games now, but even when we were playing with Brennan and stuff, our games were always very funny. Like, that's just kind of the nature of D&D. I have a hard time imagining a game, you know, like, I have a hard time imagining going to a game shop and watching people play D&D and they're not being laughing at a certain point. You know what I mean?
Like,
all,
it'd be weird.
Yeah, like, it'd be wild. Okay? So I think, like, kind of no matter what, just because at the end of the day, this is all gambling. And so it ends up being, even if someone gives a really heartwarming speech, or if they do something that they describe like really epically or beautifully, then if they roll a one or they fail or something, that's just always going to be funny. So I think that even speaks to like why you can kind of do horror genre and have it be funny, because like even horror at like its most like basic thing of like, you're just being like chased by a monster down the hall, failing to hide, that person is going to be funny in that moment. Like, they're going to panic. And it's
if they're trying to hide in the like school locker room and they can't get the door open, like, that's gonna be fun. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Sure. So that the kind of opportunity for failure, the opportunity for failure at epic moments and the opportunity for success at stupid moments, is always gonna lead to stuff being funny, even if the people playing aren't comedians or they're not trying to be funny.
And I think if you're just relaxed and being honest, I think that you will naturally find things that are funny. And just because you are, I mean, you're sat around with, you know, some people that you know and hopefully that you like on some level.
Yeah.
And I think if you are just being honest and relaxing and thinking about the, you know, just like trying to really imagine and picture stuff in your mind, like, I think naturally you're always going to find levity in those in those moments and things like that. And so, and I think it's interesting, I think, how the energy though of like different people can really heighten like stuff like the comedy or even the drama and things like that. Like, I find when I play with certain players, we've got Jonathan Charles, who plays in Outlaws and Obelisks, who is just like the master at drama when he's like as a player. Like, you know, when you play with him, in nearly every single game I've ever played with him, every four sessions or so, I end up crying. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
he's just like so good at kind of building these moments and these tensions. And then to have like Emily come in and was just like, oh my god, it was like I was suddenly like I was crying with laughter nearly every, you know, few, you know, every half an hour or something.
Right.
Even in moments, you know, where it was, you know, it's like brutal had just happened or something. You know, we were able to find like moments of levity. It was very interesting. Like there's different energies that came into the.
There was a point at which the single funniest scene in the series, followed the single most dramatic scene in the entire series.
Yeah,
one featuring Johnny, the next one featuring Emma.
Oh my god.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that was wild. I fell out of my chair laughing. So
he did.
Got that to listen,
he disappeared out of the Zoom.
I literally disappeared out of the Zoom, and I was trying so hard to like not, because I know that like rustling and,
yeah.
and doing stuff with my chair and all that is just like so unhelpful for the editor. But I just could not keep my shit together. So that was a very, very fun experience.
Yeah, no, Emily does with her character. She does as much prep as like a DM would do, not just in the mechanics of it, but just into like how they fit into the world and everything. And you hear that with our second campaign with Eldermorn and this character that she created, who's got all these like sentient books and stuff. And she found a way to be very funny in sort of a like Wednesday Addams way, in like this kind of haunted child way. So she very much found a way to like, even though the world is kind of grim, it's still got this at the center of it. The characters very much are still silly, but in sort of more of like a goth way, I guess is a way to put it.
Yeah. Well, I think she finds a way of baking the character in, right?
Yeah.
Like, to really, like, the character is just so a part of that world, almost like, and I think it fit the kind of style of the campaign so well, almost like, if you were just scanning through the world, you almost, like, wouldn't notice her character because she belongs there. It's not this like chosen one where you'd be like, oh my gosh, who is this person coming over the hill and they're surrounded by sheaths of light, and you know, and so I think that's quite an interesting thing. And I guess to flip, because we've spoken a lot about you as a DM, but like as a player, how does that process go for you in terms of like how much do you enjoy building a character that is mechanically awesome? How much do you like fitting into the world? And because I guess you're flipping probably quite a lot, right? Like it's
interesting. The Dimension 20 stuff, we end up like bulk recording that stuff a lot. So when I'm doing D20, it's like long days, and we're kind of doing it back to back. So I'm playing a lot of D20, and then I don't play for a while, and then I play a lot of D20, and then I don't play for a while, and sure, that NADPOD is just kind of like consistent. So it is always it is always fun to be a player and stuff, and I think I do, when I play, I still come at it from like a DM's perspective of, even if I'm playing like a shithead or something, I'm still doing the DM smoke and mirrors thing of being like, I'm still going to be helpful, but I'm just going to do it in like a dumb voice, or I'm going to, you know, like I'm always going to be a DM's pet. That's kind of, and because I have so much kind of control in NADPOD is like DMing and stuff, I like to, when I play a character who's more like a bodyguard, or is more somebody who's kind of just like in the background. Like, not that there are main characters necessarily in like D20 seasons, but like sometimes there are characters whose stories, like, you know, like Pete and Kingston in Unsleeping City, they kind of like their personal stories kind of feed a little bit more into the main plot. And I'm kind of, I'm happy to kind of exist on kind of the outside there and be like the background dude a little bit.
Which, by the way, if I was wearing a hat, I would take it off. Cody Night Angel Walsh is one of my all-time favorite characters in any actual play thing I've ever listened to.
Thank you.
It was like the perfect marriage of character and player, because you play such a good, obnoxious douchebag.
Yeah.
Like all of the characters in NADPOD that are just these horribly obnoxious people.
Yeah.
As soon as Cody showed up, I was like, It's appeared. He's doing it. He's done it.
He's doing it, everyone. Come, watch. He's doing it. Yeah, this is a legit question, though, because some of the characters that you managed to pull off in NADPOD are truly...
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how you make them so unbelievably unlikable, yet I desperately want them to show up.
Right.
The dwarves, like, all of the, like, kid dwarves from... I can't even remember the name of the city.
Zelbaldar or Frostwind, whichever one.
Yes.
There were teenagers in both. Caldwell, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that the whole time, one of my favorite Caldwell moments ever. I was absolutely crying at that. But yeah, how do you do it? Like, do you feel like you've just watched a lot of douchebags in your time?
Yeah, for sure. I think that one thing I kind of realized as we were playing is that players tend to hate annoying characters more than they hate evil ones. You know what I mean? Because, like, Sephiroth is cool. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
These, like, cool dudes with swords and silver hair who are just being like, and when the prophecy comes true. Like, that dude rules.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If you're just this sniveling little character who's like, I've come to destroy you. And that's always going to make your players more upset.
I've listened to the one shot recently, the live one you did in I think it was in New York that you
yeah.
did in New York.
Yeah,
did
we
it?
Just did a recent show in New York.
Yeah, you had a guest on there, and I think you're the only person that manages to top you for playing.
Oh yeah,
like the most annoying, worst douchebag ever. But I think that's a genuinely good point, because sculpting your NPCs for this purpose is one of the things that I still struggle with. Nearly every single character I feel like I made for a long stretch when I first started DMing. If I was like, if they were earnest, if they were true, if they were like the Aragorn of this world,
yeah.
My players would roll insight check after insight check after insight check, because like this kind of pure virtuosity, this, you know, everyone's like, no, I don't buy this. I don't
right.
buy
yeah.
this guy is that good. And then equally, if you had like a bad guy who was like a pure bad guy, I'm like, man, this guy's kind of cool. He's kind of got a point.
Right.
You know what I mean? He's kind of got a point.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, this
right.
is all the wrong
yeah.
way. But I think you kind of nailed it with that. And also it suits the style of the show and everything really, really well. The whole vest scene, that's all I'm going to say.
Oh my God.
Again, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely died listening to that.
That was insane. Because Emily just, she literally just said that for no yeah. reason.
Wasn't that the same battle as put your ass in the box?
Yeah.
Was it the same box?
Yeah.
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 Oh my God.
It was, yeah, that was one of the funniest fights that I had no idea that it was going to be that funny. Because at that point, it was like, this was in campaign one, we had Zach and Siobhan on, and I was running multiple like demon lord fights like back to back. And I was like, oh, this will be like the final confrontation. And then Emily calls out the vest and then the box with like the sphere of annihilation in it. Everyone's just yelling at each other to put their ass in the box.
And then, yeah, the vest comes out of nowhere. I remember listening to the short rest.
And
I think you listened back to it and you were like, the thing is, you mentioned the vest and I think I missed it, so I didn't stop it. And then everyone just like went for the vest. Like this big bad that I'd set up had this stupid vest on and was super insecure about it. But genuinely, I think it's such a good bit of advice when it comes to sculpting NPCs is like just to really think, like work out in those first few sessions who, like drop some NPCs into town and figure out who pushes your players' buttons.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Who really gets
and
them like riled up.
Them back.
Because honestly, as soon as I do like, oh, hello there, it is me. Like my home game, I'm like, I want to slit his throat. Like
yeah.
as soon as it's like this hoity-toity posh mayor of the town, whatever, it's immediate. Like I will kill them even if they turn out to be like the most altruistic person I've ever met in my life.
Right, yeah.
You know? But I do like, you know, a little, like, Cockney peasant lad, you know what I mean? Like, oh, hello there, governor. He could literally put a knife in their back and they'd be like, oh, don't worry, come here.
Yeah,
like,
right,
what?
Yeah.
You know, so I think sussing out what your players like and how they react to stuff is invaluable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, very useful.
And I think that also comes from a place of, like, everyone's going to be a lot more mad if they get their ass kicked by a character that's maybe a little silly or like has like a high status voice like that or something. They're going to be way more mad than if they get their ass kicked by, like, you know, a really cool necromancer or Sephiroth. Yeah, they're like, yeah, of course Sephiroth killed me. He rules. That's awesome.
Listen to this theme song. This is amazing. Yeah,
this is awesome.
This is the natural proceeding of things.
Yeah, of course.
I'm surprised I didn't immediately see him and give up.
I've been put in my place. This is the right thing to happen.
Please, punish me. Thank you.
I tried to join him and you wouldn't let me.
Yeah, that's also the part of the problem. Like, genuinely, I've had that several times and I'm like, can I? And I'm like, no!
Yeah.
Absolutely not. Like, you're going to turn into a Jeremy has a fun story about, the vampire or whatever.
One of the first games I was ever in, actually, I kept rolling nat 20s and basically found out that I cracked the whole campaign in like session like 3. Because it was also like I was playing roughly the first time. It was the DM's first campaign. It was rough. And I basically got all the way to finding out that the guy who had hired us all to do this job was actually the big bad and he was a vampire. And so I was like, having never really encountered a vampire in D&D before, I was like, cool. And I just pulled my shirt down and was like, here. Right here. And so he turned me into a vampire in like session 4 or something.
Wow.
And then the poor DM is trying to figure out how to like scale vampire abilities with like my PC so that I'm not massively overpowered.
There was no a Reborn or a Dampier or anything like that then. So yeah, that would have been a struggle for sure.
I'm curious. When you are going into a campaign, obviously with NADPOD, the baseline is comedy.
Right.
At what point, like, are you intentionally trying, or here's a better way to put it. Mm-hmm. When you introduce drama into the story, are you trying to introduce drama specifically? Are you trying to pace it out in terms of like, okay, the audience have had enough of this? Or are you going like, look, this is the way the character stories are going. For example, the fateful moment where Hard One fails the perception check in campaign 1.
Right.
Was that aiming at Jake? Or like I want to affect Jake in this moment? Or were you thinking like, the audience could really use a big twist here?
Oh,
and
interesting.
Sticking in some drama that way.
I think that stuff is, I think that stuff ends up being session to session of like, I try to pace out the sessions and make sure I'm not giving too many speeches, that it's not too like heavy. And maybe less, I think less maybe about the pacing of the thing overall, because try to do like a little bit of everything. And I think kind of what ends up happening is I don't really try to make my characters super, super funny. Like, it ends up with, there's moments like the vest with Akarot where it's just like, once your player gives you that, then you can kind of lean into it. But with the exception of like Galad, who like kind of had a goofy voice to start with, but even he was coming from like, I wasn't trying to be super funny with him. That was more of just like, this paladin of the light is actually completely full of shit. This is this caricature of a knight in shining armor. So like, even though he is a little bit of like a cartoon character, he was still in there for like a quasi serious reason of being like, the bad guys of this campaign are going to look like the good guys that you saw in storybooks. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think I go into it just being like, I'm just going to do kind of serious stuff. Let the players be the funny ones. And in like the, sillier moments, we just go with it and we keep the laughs rolling. And in the more serious moments, we can kind of we just follow each other's leads of being like, this character's having a moment right now. Let's give them some space to breathe and not be jumping all over them with jokes. Or they'll know I'm setting up something that's like a big twist and they'll kind of, you know, sit back and like react to that, as opposed to like, you know, playing with the scene dressing or whatever, because that easily could have been that scene where Gemma died in season one. That was set up as kind of an encounter, so she could have survived. So that wasn't even necessarily set up to be. There's a world where that becomes this very funny, bumbling scene of like hard one, like wrestling with a assassin, and then gets caught out on a balcony with his ex-girlfriend, and he's like trying to make excuses why they're alone, and you know, there's a world where that episode is just silly, you know what I mean?
Okay.
I think genuinely one of the reasons why, like, we end up referencing Nadpod, I feel like, a lot on this show, and I think genuinely one of the reasons, and definitely one of the reasons why I've loved listening to it so much, is it feels like one of the things we always preach on this show is that, like, the players have just as much agency and should have just as much agency as the DM in terms of, like, really, like, forming, like, this kind of narrative together and, like, all pulling in the same direction, all wanting the kind of most rich story to be told. And I think that, like, it's one of those shows where that's so obvious. Like, don't get me wrong, I absolutely, like, you know, Critical Role is fantastic for a lot of reasons, but there are, I think, a lot of times where it feels very much like this is Matt's world and these are people in it, which is a perfectly valid way to do it. But for, like, me and my taste, like, I love that sensation of really being in a collective space and holding that collective space and knowing that I, as the DM, can, like, kind of throw the baton to you and that you will take that and run with it and enrich my thing and turn that into a better thing and like, you know, like you said, like, push the joke further or push the drama further or you know, whatever it is, like, I can trust you to do that and I don't have to worry that you're going to take that bat and do a Luke Skywalker at the beginning of the whatever, The Last Jedi, and just throw it over your shoulder like meh, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think it, like, for that reason, I think it's one of the reasons why I think the show works really, really well, and I'd like to hope, you know, a lot of the positive feedback we've had on our actual plays has been for a similar reason, because we, I think always enjoy that sensation of pulling in the same direction.
Yeah.
Is that something conscious, do you think, for you guys, or is that just like comedy training?
Yeah, I think it's probably the same thing with you guys in that, like, I think it's one of the advantages of a smaller table. I think, like, with bigger tables, there's a lot of advantages there too, of, like, you get a lot of, like, inner party stuff where, you know, you have enough people there where there are times when, like, with D20 and, like, Critical Role and stuff, there are long stretches of time where, like, the DM doesn't even have to talk because there are so many characters there that you can do, like, just everybody kind of sitting around a campfire and they can do this, like, kind of dynamic scene. And that's a little bit harder to do with a small party, but one of the cool things with a small party is, like, what you're saying is that, like, it's small enough that it's not too many cooks in the kitchen as far as world building. Like, people can, you know, literally make up their own backstories. And even if, like, in campaign one, Emily fully built the Crick. Like, that is just like one of the players just built a town in the world. Bev or Caldwell built Beverly's entire, like, scout troop thing and everything. Hard One came up with the idea of the dwarfinage. And, you know, with, like, a small party, you're kind of able to build the entire world around your character's backstories, and it doesn't become too much of a burden. Because I think if you were trying to do that with six or seven people, that world would start getting very inconsistent. You know what I mean?
Yeah, ridiculous.
Yeah,
there'd be a lot of conflicting ideas. I think people, like, introducing. Yeah,
speaking of Critical Role, that was in campaign one towards the beginning when they had eight players.
Yeah.
There was the eighth player. One of the issues with that player was that they kept trying to be like, I'm going to call my parents and have them send the entire army over.
Right.
So we just solved this problem. It was like, no, please stop saying that you can do that.
Because that's not true.
We're not going to have that happen. We are not.
I actually remember there's a complete tangent. I remember that a time where Matt was trying to appease, like, it's just going to take them a while to get here.
Could be a few weeks to muster the forces and then a couple months to get all the food together and
roll me a D100. You get that many horses? For sure. Definitely trying to wing that. But sorry, you had a legitimate question.
I was wondering, because I don't think maybe we talked to Zach about it, but I don't remember. Correct me if I'm wrong, but basically the whole of the College Humor crew were improv trained, like UCB. Pretty much all of you guys?
Yeah, most of us. So, some more than others. I'm probably one of the least involved in the theater, or I was before. Now a bunch of the theaters have gone out of business and stuff, so it's not as big of a thing as it used to be. But I think I did the first like three or four levels of it. But Emily and Zach and Siobhan and Brennan and literally everyone but me was like, I took classes and did like the very baseline stuff. But they were all like very involved in the theater. But that stuff I think is very helpful, because particularly with you know, like one of the things you learn in improv is not to force being funny, is to like, if there's a serious moment in a scene, just go with it. Go, you know, go where it's going. You don't have to fight it to try to get every single little laugh punchline that you can,
because
it's going to end up feeling cheap, and it's not, you're not going to be able to sell it. And that is very helpful for, you know, D&D of if I hadn't done that, if we didn't have that background, I think it would have been very easy to, you know, sell yourself out in scenes that could be serious or could be poignant or something. It'd be very easy to just make a dumb joke and just deflate the whole thing. And I think like, you know, actual comedy training is helpful for that reason, for sure.
Yeah. I was going to say, listening to, I guess the, all the D20 stuff, and then certainly NADPOD, it definitely has a different feel in terms of like the pace, in terms of like the way the humor comes about, in contrast to most other games, such as like Critical Role as an example, which there's often many, many laughs, but it's not in the same way. It's like, it comes off in that, like just some people hanging out and they're like, ah, yeah, you know, your classic D&D, we're having fun playing a game. Whereas with you guys, there's a clear like, ah, yes, I know how to go into this situation. And like, you guys are playing, well, for example, the vest situation.
Right.
That to me is something that would not have worked in another group with people who hadn't been trained that way.
Yeah. And I think too, that kind of speaks to like there are so many, there's so many shows out there. And I think what's really cool is that kind of everyone does have their own style. Cause I think like we tend to have our episodes are a lot shorter than like a Critical Role or a Dimension 20 or whatever, but it ends up being, it ends up feeling kind of structured like a TV show. And then whereas like, if you're listening to like Critical Role or something, there is this very exciting sense of like, oh, I'm really listening to D&D. I'm really listening to D&D right now, and this could go really poorly for the party. This could go really great for the party, and it really feels like anything can happen. And then there's the other side of it, where if you're us, where you're like an edited show or something like that, where it's like, our advantage is that we get to almost, you know, put the show into like acts. It's almost like it's got like,
you get to curate the show a little bit.
It's a craft. There's a pace to it, and you know, I think I wouldn't be great at doing just like a kind of classic game and just letting it roll. You know, that's not as much my strong suit. But I think I love all of it. I think it's all, and I think that's what, you know, I think a lot of times DMs in their home games and stuff will listen to people who do it for a living, and they're like, oh, I want to be able to do it like this person, or my players expect me to be like this person. And I would give the advice as to that, like, people should find their strengths and really play to those. Cause even like, you know, I'm not great at voices. I can do voices, like funny ones, but I'm very bad at like accents and stuff. Whereas like, you play with Brennan, and Brennan can just, it'll just be like, and you walk into this room, and Brennan was not expecting this, but here is a shopkeeper with an Irish accent who has a beautiful little backstory. That I can't do that. You know what I mean? So I don't try to do that. You know, you just don't have to take that swing if you can't do that. You can kind of play to your strengths. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I definitely feel that. I know I know my strengths as a DM. Like, I think my strengths as a DM is improvising. Like, I genuinely think that when I'm in it and I'm live and I'm with my players and we're riffing, I feel like that's when my best things happen. And I find quite often the sessions, unless it's a combat, I find that is really good for me. Like, I really enjoy, like, laying out a combat and really knowing all the mechanics so I can more seamlessly kind of pull it off. But, like, in terms of, like, the other stuff, like, I actually find it harder, like if we just do like an RP session, I find it harder to just to run a session because I'm like, we're kind of there and we're kind of jumping to here, and then I get myself into a point where I'm focusing more on what I've written down in my notes than like what my players are saying or the things they've picked up on. And whereas, like, generally if I'm just in the flow and doing it, and so I think I would absolutely agree, like, finding out those little. And I think I would go even a step further and say, not even what you're just you're good at, what you enjoy. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you, like me, find planning, it makes you anxious because you sit there and go, oh, but the endless infinite possibilities hurt my brain, then, like, it's fine to go in with, like, a loose structure and then, you know, find your way with your players. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, that's valid. Mm. And then and there's, like, infinite approaches, I think, that you could take.
Yeah.
But, like, finding something that you enjoy so that you as a DM get something out of it as well, I think is so important. Because I think if you don't get anything out of it as a DM... Because I know some DMs, or I've spoken to some DMs before who are just like, I just DM.
They're doing it like it's a charity. And it's like, no, you're also playing the game. This is the fun part. Yeah.
Everyone's supposed to be having fun.
Yeah, exactly. So
unless you're playing with Emily Axford, in which case your life is stress.
she will destroy you.
She will break you. She makes characters to break you.
I think that, people should play to their strengths and do the things that they think are fun, you know? And I'm kind of same as you, Jasper, in that, like, I really love running combat. So we tend to have more combat than maybe other shows do. And that's just because that's kind of what I gravitate towards. And, you know, there's...
And your players too. Do you know what I mean? I think all of your players, you know, Emily loves making a badass character.
Exactly.
I think Jake is, you know, loves swinging them.
Yeah. He loves being a meathead and
So it fits.
Some tables are going to be more role play heavy. Some tables are going to be, you know, doing more combat and things like that. And I think it's just about, doing whatever you want to do and playing your strengths.
Hell yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I was going to ask. we don't have tons and tons of time, but I was curious if you wanted to talk a little bit about this. I'm very curious. You mentioned combat is one of your favorite things.
Yeah.
How do you approach combat, like running combat, inserting combat into a story? What are some tips? Brian Murphy tips? Mm. Yeah, that you might
a hot hot Murph tip. I don't like it. I don't like it when I say it.
No, not a hot Murph tip.
No.
I went a hot Murph nug, and I don't feel any better about it.
No. Nope. Frosted tips?
Yeah,
some
Murph
frosted tips, or is that worse?
That's a little better.
Is that better or worse?
That's a little bit better.
I don't know if it is. It's just a sugary version. It's
Or early 2000s, depending on early 2000s hair.
I'm thinking Smash Mouth hair, yeah.
Oh, okay. I could definitely imagine Murph with some of that.
Give us some hot, gooey tips, Murph.
Yeah, there we go.
That was the worst. Please.
I think in campaign one, as we would get to some of these, like, big boss battles, I would try to do, you know, more cinematic fights where there would really be, like, big landscape changes and stuff, like, on certain initiatives. It'd be like, you guys are on this mountain and there's an avalanche and this happens at initiative 20 and this happens at initiative 10, but also you're fighting people and it very much feels like an action movie. And in campaign two, I've kind of taken that same philosophy towards just all combat of being, like, trying to make kind of everything dynamic. So it's not just... you sit there and everybody swings their swords and we see who goes down first, because that can feel like a slog. So it's like, everything does not have to be end of the world, meteors falling down. It can be just like You're running through a tomb. There are skeletons chasing you, and it's a chase encounter. And instead of it being, you know, you're sitting there and you're swinging at them, you're trying to get away. And at every like initiative 20 or something, there's a new trap that they have to avoid, or there are enemies that are faster that they have to fight or something like that. Like, I think I draw a lot of inspiration from lair actions of just because that's kind of what originally gave me the idea for doing more kind of dynamic sets for combat, is this idea that like, these powerful creatures, they can affect the world around them. So not only do they fight, but other stuff happens. And that sort of led me to being like, well, let's pull that logic and let's say you don't need a dragon to do this. It could just be you're on a train, and when you're on a, you know, you're it's Final Fantasy VII, you're running on top of a train and fighting somebody. And there's going to be certain challenges that come with that. So in addition to the dudes you're fighting, at every initiative, you know, like you go into a tunnel and you have to, at every initiative 20, you go into a tunnel, you have to dive down. At initiative 10, the train starts to break and you have to do a dex saving throw. You might fall off or things like that. That to me always makes combat more interesting than just swinging at somebody, like really picturing it as a movie.
Yeah, and I think the foundation of D&D, right, is unpredictability, right? Like, the whole point of using dice is that there is a random chaos element thrown in. And so I feel like then accentuating that, I think, with the surroundings, with the environment, and with what the a creature can do is only ever going to serve to make it more of the thing, like more D&D. Like I always feel like I always try to throw in a bit of a chaos element, you know, like much like you were saying then, like something that could move or shift. Like I remember I always used to be obsessed with did you ever play the Soul Calibur game?
Yes, of course.
And you could like punch someone so hard you'd like go into like a different arena.
Yes.
Or you'd like go through the floor, or like you'd go into like the nether realm or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I always thought like that is like the kind of how I love the idea of combats. Like the you know, I always think like if you're in a tavern, set it on fire, because it just becomes so much more fun and chaotic when suddenly you're like, oh, I've got to avoid pockets of fire.
Yeah.
And every round it's getting worse and there's smoke and there's this. And I just think it just builds more of a... And the thing for me, it builds more of a picture in my head. It gives me more fun to imagine into, especially if we're doing theater of the mind, instead of it just being like kind of RuneScape, you know, if you've played that, where you just kind of like swing
minus five.
Yeah. Like exactly. Instead of it being like that, you're now in this, like you said, this like cinematic kind of diving all over the place, wielding your spells and your swords and everything. So always fun to throw in chaos elements like that for sure.
Yeah.
I'm very, very conscious of the time. So the last thing that we always do with all of our guests is we ask for a tale from the table. So this can be a story that could have happened at a home game. It can be on D20, on NADPOD, whatever it is. But it's something wild that sticks in your mind. It can be heartfelt. It can be emotional. It can be wild and ridiculous. It can be... you know, someone calling your bad guy to vest, whatever you want to do.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. We had a home game where the player, M, was playing with me, and then it was a bunch of my friends from home, from New Jersey, that we would play over Zoom, and occasionally we'd go home for holidays and stuff, we'd play with them. So we had a crew that had been, we played for a while, and they were in sort of like this like frigid north area with all these like frost giants and everything. So there was this like adventure that they went on where this one frost giant was like getting beat up by the other frost giants and stuff. But he was also still like kind of a shithead. Like he was just like this like meathead. But they were able to like align themselves with him. And they had this like frost giant that went around with them for a little bit. That was built just for a particular encounter that I had planned like for the next session, which was like this big, there was like going to be this attack on the city, and like the frost giant was going to like help them out in sort of just like a lair action-y way. I try to kill the frost giant in like a sacrificial way during the battle. doesn't happen. Emily saves him. Emily is a cleric and just keeps healing him. And anytime I'm like, just go on without me, she's like, I literally will not leave with you. Literally, they can kill all of us. I will not leave without you. So then he survives, right? So I'm like, cool, happy ending. This is all done. The next leg of the adventure involves them going through these caverns. So we'll do like a goodbye, like, hey, sorry, I'm a frost giant. Can't fit in there. see you guys later. And all of the players just go like, no, you know what? We're not going to go in the cave. And I'm like, but that's where you have to go. That's where all the stuff is. That's where the underground passage is to the next city. And you guys have to go there. And they're like, well, what else can we do? Where can we go with him? And I'm like, I guess you can just wander off into the frozen tundra. Like, you can just go off and maybe die. And they're like, yeah, no, we'll do that. We'll do that. And so then I had to base an adventure. It ceased to be this big sort of like epic thing of where they're getting to the next place and getting to the next place. And then it became a survival campaign for a while of just them and this frost giant camping in the tundra. And I had to build a whole adventure around him where essentially there was like a society.
He was the chosen one.
Literally, the only way I was able to get rid of this dude was to, they climbed a mountain, they got to the top, and there were like cloud giants. And basically, like, in order for them to get the help that they needed for some other thing, they needed like a giant on this council of like decision makers. I had to build a whole giant like Senate to get rid of this dude. To get rid of this dude. So they had to like, they did this like fight to get rid of one of the guys that like was like not voting to help the humans or something. And then they were able to like install their giant in to like tip the vote. It was like this weird political theater of just literally because they wouldn't go in a cave. And they're just like, I'd rather wander off into the tundra than leave behind our cool frost giant friend.
You truly know that you are off the rails when you go into like full political systems
out of like a normal quest game.
Political
drama.
Just to get this dude out of the party, because I'm like, you can't have a frost giant in your party. I just can't let you do this. And they're like, I'm sorry, you gave him to us. He's our friend. And even if I try to kill him, they're like, I will lay down my life for him. Like, he is my best friend.
I have a similar issue at the moment where I got my players to, the first time I've ever done it, and a cool little tip, I'd advise it was very fun. I got my, they all started out on a ship, on a pirate boat, and I got them to create NPCs that they knew for like a little bit of time. So like they rolled like random like race, and then they would just decide on the spot like, oh, they're this and I've known them for this long and da 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 da. And now we have a situation where Erdl the cabin turtle, so he's like a little cabin boy who does like all the cleaning and mopping and stuff, and he's just this really small young turtle. He just goes everywhere. Erdl the cabin boy is just now everywhere, and I am like, guys, he has like 11 HP. Admittedly, he has a decent armor class because he's a turtle. Right. But like, I'm like so deathly afraid of killing this thing because they're gonna go wild if I kill him. It's just
dude, you gotta kill him.
I know, right? That's the thing. That they're baiting me to do it, and they always say they're not. And I'm like, dudes, if you leave him on the ship will be fine because you need to get off the island. I'm not gonna be that cruel to like make you swim. You know what I mean? So the ship, you know, the ship will be fine. But you know,
you gotta kill him, and then if they bring him back, have him be like, please stop doing this. That was the worst experience I've ever had.
Please let me die.
Please let me stay on the ship. I was happy when I was on the ship. Why did you do this to me?
So yeah, I feel the pain. I feel the pain very real. But Brian Murphy, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been such a pleasure to get to talk to you today about all these wonderful things. And I think there was quite a lot of DM tips in there. That was nice. That was a good pearls of wisdom in there.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This was a blast. I love talking to you guys about D&D.
It was very, very cool. And yeah, long may the 3BH NADPOD crossover continue.
Yes, yes, yes.
It seems
much
to
more to come.
A...
Much more to come, certainly.
Yeah, I hope so. So, speaking of, where can we find more of your stuffs on the internet?
Maybe
some Twitter that you may or may or not use.
Yeah, not as much of a Twitter guy these days. I would just say, just listen to NADPOD. If you're not already checking it out, check it out. All our socials are NADDPOD, and then just search Not Another D&D Podcast. Don't sing yet. Whatever it is, wherever it is that you listen to podcasts.
Nice. And if you do listen to both shows, you can take the adorned title that I chose for the patrons, for the people on the Discord who came over from NADPOD, which is Nadlings. I mean, who doesn't want to be a little Nadling?
Yeah, yeah. The Nadling nation continues to grow.
It does. We have so many on our on our Discord. It's truly wild.
That's amazing.
Because we've had all of you guys on the show, so shout out to all the Nadlings that are listening to this episode. Yeah.
The rubber faced Infinity Gauntlet. Gross.
Yeah. That's what all the Nadlings look like. They're tadpoles, but with your silicon faces sort of stretched.
The fact that they're rubber makes it so much worse. Yeah. Truly,
I'm really imagining now that they were actual tadpoles that had their tails removed and then were just attached to the gauntlet.
Oh, that makes
so the reason
so
they're rubbery
worse.
Is because they're amphibians. Mm. They're that weird rubbery amphibian.
Is this
skin.
Like some genetic splicing to get the faces on them and everything? Oh man. Oh, that's so not okay. But if you have enjoyed this and you want to find more of our stuff, you can check us out on the social medias at TB Halflings. We're also on Patreon, which is patreon.com/TB Halflings. We're doing merch. It's really, really cool. You can even, we need to shout this out more often, you can get some of the incredible soundtracks that was made by Jonathan Charles for all of our characters for as little as £1 or $1 on our tip jar. And you just get music for free. Go get it. Yep. Go check it out. But this has been very fun. I think that's everything. I don't think there's anything else that
we've started plugging our socials.
Oh, lately. Yeah. We have our
Jasper,
our
socials. Jasper, tell them where you are on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter at JW_Cartwright.
Yeah. And I'm at JeremyCobb1. That's Cobb with two Bs.
Cobb with two Bs. And do you know what? Screw it. I will never stop plugging this because it was very, very cool. Go and check out the two-shot I did over on NADPOD.
I was about to say the same thing. Yeah. Search Bohemia two-shot to see the ultimate crossover.
Yeah, no, a wild, wild adventure was indeed had. But on that note, we will see you next week. So long, Shire folk.
So long, Shire folk.
So long, Shire folk.
Halflings, it is about that time that we thank some extra special people who signed up to our Patreon and to shower you with all of our Halfling thanks. We appreciate you so much being on the Patreon. It is the main way that we fund this show and keep bringing you awesome content and are able to do awesome stuff like Outlaws and Obelisks. So if you want to see more stuff like that, then please feel free to check out our Patreon. And if you're already a patron, thank you so much. Thank you for everything you do and thank you for being here. So without further ado, I would like to say a huge thank you to Ethan Pollard, Lindsay Watson, Liam Datwani, Hartswell, Kendra Carson, Connor Murphy, Dr. Kate, Grumpius? I kind of love that one. Amelia Lombardi, that is a great name. Wow, well done. Prowsey, we have Ganonbort, Chineal, David, Oliver Orgerton, Paul McHugh, Undead Raccoon, Felix N. Garcia Jr. Epic. So epic. Devin Waldbilling. Waldbilling. Nice name, my dude. Nice name. Clay Walden, Joe H. We have Kavanagh Golka, Flo Ramirez, Buff Venom. Why not? Why wouldn't you want Buff Venom? You know, why would you have Skinny Venom when you could have Buff Venom? Alea, Xavier, hilarious, Xavier M. Peterman, love that. Henry Frank, Reach Cypress, Kit Forks, Ben Dorian, and Jeep Geek. Thank you so much for being and choosing to become patrons of our little show. We hope that you enjoy all the content that is here. And, as always, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week. So long, Shire folk.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.